Hello and welcome to the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast, where we explore the fields, kitchens, and stories that make the Massachusetts food scene so special. I'm your host, Nissa Gadbois. Each week, we'll connect with farmers, food producers, and the community that makes the Commonwealth's food scene so vibrant. Join me as we meet the passionate farmers, food producers, and chefs who are shaping the farm-to-table movement right here in Massachusetts. Hello, and welcome back to episode 2 of the Massachusetts Farm-to-Table podcast. This week, I'm really pleased to have with me Sam Stabner from Whittier Farms in Sutton, Massachusetts. Sam and her family operate a diversified farm, including dairy, beef, and vegetables. Their farms are located in Sutton, Douglas, and Oxford. They offer wholesale, retail, and CSA. Whittier Farms is part of the Cabot Cooperative, and we talked a little bit about how that helped their family's farm during the pandemic. And also, we talked about how the pandemic changed their farm in a lot of ways for the better. She also offers some good advice to folks who are interested in becoming farmers. So stay tuned, it's going to be a great episode. Good morning, Sam, and welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Nissa. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Looks beautiful where you are.
It is. Should be a good day.
Sam, can you tell me a little bit about your family's farm?
Sure. So Whittier Farms is a multi-generational dairy, beef, and vegetable farm in the heart of central Massachusetts. We're located in Sutton. We're actually closer to the 395 highway than we are the 146 corridor. We farm in Sutton as our hometown. And then also crop in Oxford and Douglas. So we're nestled right in the corner and have the ability to farm in three communities. I said multi-generational. I'm the fifth generation to do this with my sister, her husband, my husband, and our parents, and our uncle. So it's as well as a lot of non-family staff from our community that helped make this all possible.
That's really incredible. You said fifth generation. What year was that when it started?
So 1945 is when my great grandfather, his brother, and their father decided to purchase two foundation Holsteins and take kind of, you know, the family farm into a business. And I always like to tell everybody, like, think about the economic situation that was happening in New England at that time period and some of the changes that were coming about. And it all kind of starts to make sense as to what they were starting to do. They had an opportunity to buy those cows, really lay the roots in dairy and move forward from there. They were able to buy a couple pieces of property as the years went on to grow their business. And over the years, our family has been in everything from dairy to equipment sales, landscaping. They got into some excavation work at one point, and they've always diversified. So for my family currently, the vegetables came about as a 4-H project in the 70s. Now it's a 20-acre project that has just, it's full-fledged business on its own. And we have, you know, we kind of always share that it started as a 4-H project. So always encourage your kids to do what they want and just help them succeed, because you never know. The beef started out as we needed to do something more than just putting our bull calves on the auction trailer. We weren't making money doing that. We had started hearing about local beef and some of the successes people were having. So we decided we were getting $5 per calf when they were going on the trailer at that time. And this was about 10 or 12 years ago. So my dad's words were, well, let's try raising a couple steers. We have to make $5 or more. We almost didn't make $5 on our first one. And that's because nobody knew we had beef. They didn't have a clue. And if people don't know you have a product, you're not going to sell it. So here we are, we got a, freezers full of beef, brand new product, no customers. So it took a lot of grassroots, a lot of just word of mouth to tell people, we're raising beef, we're starting this, we're giving it a go. And I can tell you a decade later, we're doing very well with our beef.
Right.
As a consumer myself of the beef, the flavor is fantastic, but just from, management perspective and business perspective, the beef was a great diversification for Whittier Farms. The vegetables, like I said, from the 70s, today we've actually branched out, and instead of just doing wholesale and retail, we have included farm shares as part of our vegetable production. So we're making that a big piece of what we do. And our farm store has been open to the public in some fashion pretty much since the start of that 4-H project in the vegetable field. As soon as they started having extra vegetables from the 4-H project, my dad opened a little card table with a tackle box, cash box. And today, that tackle box and cash box is a year-round building, with, electronic point of sales and, a full staff and people coming in every day throughout the year, which is just a testament to what the community needed and what we've been able to provide to our community.
So you've been in the community for a long, long time. I imagine the support has been really good for you all.
We're fortunate. A lot of times I don't think there's not a lot of big farms around us. Like, it's not like Woodstock, Connecticut. It kind of comes to mind when you think, oh, it's a big agricultural community. But there's a lot of people that are very interested in farming around us, and they understand that farming has a historical root here in Sutton, Oxford, and Douglas, and they're very willing to support those ventures. And I think just the general sense of people right now, they want to know where their food's coming from. They want more than just what's available in the grocery store. So people are very interested. We're five generations into this. You wouldn't be five generations without the community that's around you. So we really, really try to recognize that through our farm tours and community engagement to recognize that we would just be a farm with a wholesale market without our community. But instead, we have the opportunity to put it, vegetables that are harvested in the morning are being eaten for dinner across our community because people come out to support us.
So, you've got a lot going on. So, if you could pick one of your farm enterprises and take us from the beginning, either a seed or the birth of a calf, right through the end of production,
Yeah.
what that
So
look like?
I'll do something a little bit different, right? So I think we've got a huge community in the farm to table network of people that are doing vegetables and beef or apples and things like that. So why don't I do dairy? For Whittier Farms, we are one of about 500 farm families in New York and the six New England states that are part of the Cabot Creamery Cooperative. So all the milk from our cows since 2008 has been sold to the Cabot Creamery Cooperative. Another brand name is Agrimark. So Agrimark is kind of the farm name, the farm family's names, and then Cabot is kind of the consumer facing name that everybody's familiar with. Cabot cheese and butter, whipped cream, sour cream, cottage cheese. So for Whittier Farms, the process looks, we'll start at the beginning, right? So we do all of our breeding in-house. We're not relying on another farm for that aspect. We're breeding, birthing, and raising right here at our facility. So calves are born throughout the year. We don't do a seasonal calving. We have calves born throughout the year. We are so yeah, calves will be born. We have a separate calving facility in located inside of our barns that we can provide mom and the calf with a clean and warm, especially, in the winter months or cool in the summertime area, that's separate from all the other hurt animals and just very similar to humans, when you want a space that's safe and comfortable. Same thing for our calves. That's kind of where we are able to ensure optimal success for both mom and the calf. The calf will then be raised here at Whittier Farms. Mom will get any care that she needs and then go back with our milking herd. Then the calf will be raised in a calf hutch. Because of our location and where kind of how many cows we have and what we're doing, we have a number of calf hutches that we can provide individualized care to those animals. The calf will be in the calf hutch for just a couple of months while she's bottle fed and then bucket trained and then starting to eat a little bit of hay and grain and then moving from an all milk based diet to, that weaning process until she's fully on water. And at that point, she'll move from an individual hutch to a double hutch, where that process is trying to get those two animals to share. And I equate this to anybody that has, we do a lot of preschool tours. So we get to kind of see that firsthand in humans as well as our calves. And it is so similar to watch that process. There's a little bit of bumping that goes wrong along with those two calves as they try to figure out, we both have to get to the feed bunk. We both need to get to the water. And we both need an area in the pen to sleep. So you get to see that process, and it's just part of animal nature. And then from the calf hutch, that calf will begin her journey through our heifer barn. So a heifer is a female cow that has not had a calf yet, and we will raise our cows based on age and size through our barn. So she'll be grouped with animals in similar age and size as she goes into the barn and through this as she ages. And at about 2 years old, she will have her first calf herself. So the process kind of begins again. Once she has her first calf, she'll begin milking, and join our dairy herd. So we'll go back right there to the milking animal. The milk, our cows are milked, excuse me, the milking cows are in a barn. There's currently about 75 cows milking here at Whittier Farms. And in that barn, they are in free stalls, so they have the freedom of movement throughout the day to go to their stall, to go to water, to go to the feed bunk. Great ventilation. Actually, on a day like today, beautiful in March, most of our cows will probably be in our south yard just soaking up the sunshine. You get into 70, 80 degree weather in the summertime, and they're going to be kind of hiding out in the shaded spots in the barn because they can. They're not tied out to one of the stalls. We pasture our dry animals right now. So any of the cows that are basically waiting to have their calf, they're dry about 2 months ahead of their calving. So those are our pastured animals. Right now, we don't pasture our milking herd. The milking animals are milked twice a day. We milk in the early morning and then mid-afternoon. And we currently see a milk truck every other day. So the milk truck will pick up loads of milk from our farm, as well as other farms in the area, and truck it to the nearest dairy processing facility. For Cabot, it's West Springfield, Mass, is their butter facility, butter and dry milk powders. So geographically, I can tell you that a lot of our loads of milk head that way. Because we have a retail farm store, Whittier Farms is then able to go one more step with our co-op. We buy direct from our co-op every single month to fill our farm store with, I'm willing to say it out loud because I don't have anything on paper that says I'm not. But in my observations, we have the largest selection of Cabot cheese in the area. So right now we carry over 50 different Cabot products, and it's amazing. We could do the same thing with vegetables. Like I said, vegetables being picked in the morning are being eaten in the afternoon by our community. You can come into our store and you can buy a tenderloin steak and take it home and grill it for dinner that night.
I'm curious, how were you all impacted in that whole process during the pandemic when things were not moving very easily across state lines? Did it affect Cabot Co-op?
Yeah, so from our perspective, it was kind of a tricky time as well. I'm going to try to not give a milk economics lesson here, but We'd need a lot longer day for that. But there was a lot happening in the milk market just before the pandemic. Our co-op was right in the middle of trying to institute a base access program to kind of deter excess milk from coming into the co-op. But the base access program was something that started right before the pandemic. So when the pandemic hit and wholesale, your schools, your institutions, a lot of your businesses aren't buying products for their cafeterias, or restaurants aren't buying from the marketplace, it changed Cabot's products. So a lot of, and just like a lot of other people that were involved in food service and retail, you had to have almost this overnight shift into retail. And Cabot was no different. Just like we were managing at our farms, the safety of our families and our staff and our customers, Cabot was trying to do the same thing while still, milk's not one of those things that you can put in dry storage and say, when this is all over, we'll come back to it. We still had to get milk out in there. So milk trucks still had to come to the farm. We, tried to make sure that from the farm level, we took precautions to make sure that our drivers had, the same safe access that they've always had. Try to tell, our herdsmen and anybody that's around that anytime a driver, whether it be the milk truck driver or a farm store delivery driver, just the same thing everybody was being told, give space, wash your hands, give a little bit extra space, but from a milk perspective, milk's got to flow. It's got to go somewhere. Cabot was definitely faced with some challenges in making sure that things had to move. And that's why being part of the co-op is definitely beneficial for us, is that that responsibility was one that our family didn't have to take on. That was people in the co-op were taking on that responsibility of making sure milk was still moving. And at the farm level, we were responsible for making sure that our farm was safe, our people were safe, and we kept driving forward. So, on top of the dairy, we have a farm store. The grocery stores were overrun. So when Walmart and the grocery stores didn't have anything in the pandemic, they came running to our farm store. We changed our process overnight. We actually locked the front doors of our farm store and we serviced all of our customers out in the driveway. That kind of initial panic response, because, and it was a warranted response. The night before we came back from an event and our store was just swamped with people. I was watching people just grabbing everything in sight because national news was that we were shutting down for 2 weeks, right? The infamous 2 weeks. And it looked like a mob scene that literally overnight we just started talking about, that's not safe. Regardless of what's going on in the world, like, people panicking is not safe. So how can we make this safer for our staff and our family and our customers and make sure that we can help everybody in the process? So we did. We came in and it was Saturday morning, March 14th. My mom said to me, she goes, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know." And I said, "What happens if we close our doors?" She goes, "We can't close. Like, we can't afford to close. You just, as a business, you can't afford to close." I said, "No, but like, what if we don't let people in the store and we go to them, go to their cars?" She said, "We can try it." So that instituted a months long process that evolved into exclusive curbside pickup. People would call us, or, and then we later built an online platform for ordering using Square. We didn't have one, so when I say we built it, we used Square's templates and stuff and got it running essentially overnight. And we had people just call in or go online and order from us. And like I said, we did that for months. And because of the footprint of our farm store, we realized that we just couldn't physically service enough people in a day to open our doors. We kept our doors closed through 2021 and actually opened a window, a sliding window. So, like, think of an ice cream window. We had our building is already equipped with those. My grandfather thought when they in the building process, he wanted to serve ice cream, but we have the sliding windows. So we started using window service. You could come to the window, place your order. It was very reminiscent of the kind of the old school grocery stores where you'd go to the counter and then somebody would go, you know, to the back and get all your stuff. So we did that until the spring of 2021. And now we jump forward, you know, to 2024, and our farm store has, the doors have been open for years now, and people are back in store. It's just like the world. We definitely see people moving forward and going about their life, but our farm store has changed because of the pandemic. We have changed most of our products in store, have evolved. We have changed the physical layout of our store more times than I can count to better our community. And you know what? It's working. It's working. We get up every day and hope that people will come to the farm store and purchase from us. And every day we're listening to them to hear what else they want. What else can we do to make your experience better?
I think every day is a new adventure. And how we interact with our customers, you know, finding new channels to do that and just relating to them, you know, in-person connections have really meant a lot to people over the last 4 years. And we're just trying to continue to build on that. I mean, I had somebody mention to me the other day that, wow, like you guys are so busy. The calendar of events is just huge right now. And I'm like, it's pretty comparable to years before the pandemic. You know, for the last few years, we've been trying to rebuild and figure out what we need. Right now, we're able to do some more in-person farm tours and just reconnect with people. And a lot of folks that are here in our community have moved to the area, whether it be to be back closer to family or because they moved out of cities. We've got a lot of people that were from the Metro West area and have decided to move outside that 495 beltway to be a little more space for a growing family, or because they don't have to commute anymore into the city. So they just wanted a change. So we have a lot of new people around us that want to know, well, why should I shop at Whittier's instead of going down to Walmart or Market Basket? So we're trying to show that to them. And then we've got a lot of customers as well in, I say customers, but in reality, they're neighbors, they're friends, they're people we see all the time. You know, they feel like so much more than a customer. They've got grandchildren that live in the area now, or they retired through the pandemic. So, you know, now they have the opportunity to connect with us in a new way too. So it might not feel like it's a new way of connecting, but it's just newer connections with people. And that's been kind of special to be part of.
Yeah, it's been great. I love how the farming community came together, how folks came together to support farmers. Really great. And I think it has changed the landscape a little bit.
Yeah, it was certainly a unique experience. We try to, you know, for as challenging as it was and as dark as it got for a little bit there, we have really tried as a family to find the positives in it. I mean, I know directly for Whittier Farms, in our family, the pandemic showed my sister that she had a place here at the farm instead of her medical path that she was on. She was in school for athletic training and kind of a pre-physical therapy route.
Yeah.
And the pandemic forced her obviously to do remote schooling, and we more or less voluntold her for some stuff here at the farm store. And she realized that this is where she wanted to be. So she became our farm store manager.
Wow.
At the same time, her then boyfriend, I guess, became kind of frustrated in his position with the way stuff was going at the company he was working for. They got engaged and they got married just over about a year and a half ago now. And he is our crops and equipment manager now. So for our family, you know, we just had that super positive influx of Diana and Brett recognizing that they needed to be here,
yeah.
You know, and that was really key. And it just really, yeah, I mean, there's so much We could talk forever about all the changes, but we have really tried to take something that was so terrible, and that was much more than 2 weeks,
A little bit
and just
longer.
a little bit longer, try to make it a big positive for us.
Yeah,
So.
that's great. So you mentioned just sliding back to how your vegetable enterprise was sort of a 4-H thing. So what would you give for advice to young folks who want to get into farming?
That is a great question. As somebody who was born and raised in farming, I guess I have kind of like a two-prong approach, right? So as a fifth generation farmer, the best thing that my parents did was they didn't tell us we had to farm. They would ask us for help. You know, as kids, it's fun to help. You know, they always had extra supplies that were real, but they were our size. So I think that made a huge difference in our life that we weren't forced into it. I personally played soccer my growing up, like right through college, and my parents were more than supportive of that. That they didn't sit there and say, "You have to do 4-H, you have to join this, you have to do that." It was, I wanted to play soccer, so they said, "Okay." And a testament to my mother, who is a saint, she drove me up and down the East Coast so that I could play soccer. And washed all my muddy laundry from those glorious spring mud games. And they did that 3 times over. My brother and my sister played. So they supported us. And I think that allowed us to recognize that there was opportunities beyond the farm. I know for myself, I did pursue a couple of those opportunities until I got to a point where it just felt right to be here. It just felt that this was home and this is what I was born to do. And when you get that feeling, you know, if there's somebody listening that's in farming and is, you know, part of a family farm that's not sure if they want to continue, you will know that undeniable moment when it just consumes you that this is what you're supposed to do. And I think for somebody that's not in farming that is looking at this saying, wow, you know, like generational farmers, they always have that opportunity. Not really. We have had to grow and change and adapt and transition so that I had a role, my sister had a role, her husband had a role, my husband has a role, and you don't just jump in. You have to wait for the right time. You know, you have to earn it, you have to work for it. And there's things that I have had to learn because I didn't know. And it felt at times, I remember being in my mid-20s and thinking, I feel stupid because I've had to ask a question that there's some teenagers that are farming that they know this. When I was a teenager, I was playing soccer and looking at other opportunities. Didn't think that I would need to know that. So you can learn at your own pace. And I think that that's important to know. So I guess, you know, for that young person that wants to farm, just get started. Just go. Just do it. I heard some great advice the other night from a gentleman who was retiring. He is not a farmer. He has built a business for the last 39 years and is retiring so that his 2 adult children are taking over the business. His, I believe he said, father always told him, he started his company with $500 in his pocket. And his father said to him, his kids were like 3 and 5 at the time. And he said, "Don't worry, if anything happens, they always have a place to stay." So you can do anything if you have the right people around you to support you. You know, so just to hear that from a non-farmer, that he had family saying, go try it, do it. We've got your back," was important, you know, and as the young farmers listening that wants to start, and we're saying young, but let's be honest, there's people out there that start farming when they retire from their other career,
Right.
that if they're listening to you, just go try it, go do it.
And I've found, because my husband and I don't come from farming families.
Yeah.
So we're new to this, but we found that other farmers were so supportive and so helpful. And anytime we had a question that, whether it was a big question or a seemingly insignificant question, like, duh, we should know this, they were always there with advice. And the one thing that I've learned over more than a decade now is that nobody has all the answers. Nature's going to do what nature's going to do. And you just have to kind of feel your way a lot of the time, too.
I don't know how it works in other industries because I haven't been part of those other industries, but I know for farming that if you have a question and you find a farm that you can connect with, 9 times out of 10, that farmer's gonna just say, "Oh, okay, come here, I'll show you what I do." You know, and they're gonna show you their whole farm because they recognize that farming is, you don't do it for yourself. If you're doing it for yourself, you're doing it wrong, I think. You know, you gotta farm because you care about the land, you care about the animals, and you care about your community, right? And I think that that's where a lot of farmers, they do recognize that if I can help somebody else, you know, and like you said, you and your husband are first generation farmers, and you didn't come from farm families. Well, even though we're fifth generation, at one point, our first generation didn't either. They started it out. You know, did they know that would be sitting here talking about the fifth generation? Probably not. Probably never even crossed their mind. So, and I've got a friend of ours in Western Mass. He's the 13th generation on his farm. You got to start somewhere, I
You
guess.
have to start, all of us start somewhere,
Got to
right?
start somewhere.
Yeah.
That's it. Yep.
Okay,
So.
so last question. Here's a fun one. If you could invite three people, living or historical, to your farm for dinner, who would they be?
You know, I've thought about this because you did send this one over early. And I think I'd just invite my family.
Yeah.
But if we're just going to sit down for dinner, I'm happy just sitting down with my family.
Would
So
it be?
it sounds so stupid, but it's
No,
true.
it's not. How would it be if you had the first generation of your family could sit at the table with you now? What would that be like? What would you say?
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be what were you thinking? There's so many. I guess it would be, yeah, okay, so let's look at that. Like if we were to sit down with the first generation of Whittier Farms, there's a lot of questions. I was only in middle school when my grandfather died. So we've been without him here at the farm for a very long time. And there's a lot of questions because of that we haven't had the connection to our previous generations to ask.
Yeah.
Now we talked about the pandemic and trying to find the positive in that. And I give my parents so much credit because my grandfather died young, they were put in a position to kind of dig out and figure out how we moved on. And they did that. So I think for us sitting down with the previous generations would be a lot of, what were you thinking? What did this mean? What did that mean? Why did you do this? Because we haven't been able to figure that out. You know, and there's a lot of things that we've just moved forward with, and there's a lot of we've always kind of looked forward into how can we be sustainable from, you know, everything, sustainability from an environmental perspective.
Right.
But for us, it's sustainability for family, for financial, sustainable equipment, sustainable facilities.
Yeah.
And we've always had to try to look forward because we didn't have a lot of time to look back and dwell on the past.
Yeah.
So if we could sit down with the first, second, third, even, you know, third generation, I think there would just be, it would have to be a very long dinner, probably definitely five courses.
Excellent. And you've got enough of a production that you could do whole five courses just from your own farm, probably.
Yeah, we could. It'd be fun.
They'd be super proud of you, I'm sure. Sam, thanks so much for coming on the podcast with me today. Sorry about all of our technical glitches, but I think we did okay.
It happens. We adapt. Thank you, Nissa, for giving us and the other farmers an opportunity and a way to share our stories, a way to connect with people. For anybody that's listening, you know, just get out and connect. For the farmers that are listening, keep doing what you're doing, because you're doing the hard work.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
This episode of the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast is brought to you by Renaissance Farms Permaculture and the shop at Renaissance Farms. Please visit them online, and while you're there, sign up for the weekly newsletter and get 15% off your next order from the shop. Each edition of the newsletter includes farm news, articles, recipes, and updates on upcoming classes, courses, workshops, and special events. Subscribers also receive exclusive subscriber-only discounts each week. Links are in the show notes. Thank you for joining us on another delicious journey through the Massachusetts Farm to Table podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to follow us on social media and join our Facebook group, where you can join the local farm-to-table movement. Links are in the show notes. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future guests, we'd love to hear from you. Please drop us a line at massachusettsfarmtotable@gmail.com. Until next time, remember to eat local, support your farmers, and keep the farm-to-table movement moving. Thanks for listening.